Today on the Rising Coaches Podcast.
We've been good, but we've found a way to be at our best, you know, that back end of February and into March. And so I think we take a lot of pride in our prep with scouting and also in our skill work. I would say those are two really big, like, foundational things in our program, is, and not just skill work in terms of shooting, but we do a lot of defensive footwork stuff that most programs, you know, will do in their preseason stuff, and then once they get in a season, they kind of go away from.
Hello and welcome to the Rising Coaches Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Bender, and today's episode is brought to you in part by one of our favorite sponsors, Dr. Dish. Dr. Dish is by far the best shooting machine on the market, and if you want a discount off a new machine, be sure to mention Rising Coaches to save up to $300. For more information, visit drdishbasketball.com or visit one of their social media platforms at Dr. Dish B-Ball. Also, if you're not already a member and are interested in joining the largest coaching tree in basketball, visit risingcoaches.com to sign up today. You'll build genuine relationships with other coaches, have amazing access to new and brand new content every single week, and will allow you to develop your craft, expand your network, and see job opportunities that may not be available anywhere else. Join Rising Coaches today to have access to our member site. And today's special guest, Austin Johnson, good friend of mine, Lewis Clark State College, NAI Coach of the Year, back-to-back years, lost the national championship last year, done an unbelievable job. Coach Johnson, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Excited to talk basketball.
Definitely. So how'd you end up at Lewis Clark State College?
Some days I ask myself that same question. I played small college basketball. I played a year, I was at a junior college for a year in Kansas, and then finished up at a small college in Oklahoma. And after my sophomore year, I knew I wanted to get into college coaching. So I actually thought about quitting and going to a bigger school and being like a student manager or somehow getting involved, just because I had no network. But got connected with a couple people who told me, hey, you should go work camps. And so worked a bunch of camps in my last two summers of college in between seasons, and met a lot of great people, and thought I had, you know, like a lot of people probably thought I had something for sure locked up as a GA at a certain school. And then probably 2 days after I graduated from college, I found out that had fallen through. So I had nothing. And my parents weren't too happy about that. They wanted me to have a job, you know, a real job right out of college. And so they made me go like interview for the Air Force and stuff. And this is in 2008, when things were still pretty hot and heavy in Iraq and Afghanistan. And my dad was in the Air Force, so they wanted me to go interview with them. I went and did some temp jobs and folded clothes at a Western clothing warehouse. And then fortunately, the coach that recruited me to junior college, Dennis Helms, he's a National Junior College Hall of Fame coach. He was back at Odessa College, and he had said, hey, I got basically a part-time/volunteer setup, and, you know, this is your best option. It's your only option if you want to coach. And so I took it and ran the next day. I packed up my car and drove to West Texas, and had no idea what I was getting myself into, but loved Coach Helms a ton. And he was a huge, you know, mentor for me as both a player and as a coach. And so got down there right as really summer started, and they had guys on campus during the summer. So I got to work out with them and kind of coach them during the summer. And then, just kind of randomly got connected with a coach that I had played against in college, had taken an assistant job at Western Illinois University for Jim Molinari, who's a, you know, he's at Boston College now. He's a very successful, he's won, I think, over 300 games as a Division I head coach, and also been a high major assistant coach at different spots. And so I knew who Coach Molinari was because I'm a Midwest guy. I grew up in Kansas, and but never met him. I honestly had never heard of Western Illinois, but I knew I wanted, you know, as a small college guy with no Division I connections, I, you know, and like everybody, I assumed Division I is the greatest thing in the world. And so I knew if I didn't take that GA spot at Western Illinois, that was, I mean, Odessa was a big time JUCO and Coach Helms a big time JUCO coach. So, I mean, in hindsight, maybe there would have been some, you know, some sexier GA jobs that would have opened up after a year or two at Odessa, but I just felt like I needed to take the sure thing. And it was a really good deal as far as getting my master's paid for and a little bit of a stipend. And And I didn't know it at the time, but Western Illinois was so far behind basketball-wise, they did not have a third assistant coach. And so at age 23, I was the GA, but I also got to do scouts and be on the court and coach. I mean, I was also doing the study halls and other, you know, GA things. But at age 23, I was kind of thrown in the fire in various ways. And so we weren't great. It was the beginning of a try to rebuild it. But for a young guy, it was awesome to just have so much on my plate and have to decide if this is really what I want to do with my life. And, love Coach Mo. He's definitely a hard driving guy to work for, but I think that was a really good, you know, blessing for me again, to decide if this is what I want to do. And learned a lot about, you know, competing with less resources, from my time there. And so was finishing up my 2 years there in grad school, and like everybody else finish up their GA spots, I got to decide, you know, do I want to stay in this Division I world and try and go get a video or an administrative spot on a Division I staff? But I really wanted to be on the court. I felt like for me at some point I was going to have to figure out if I could A, coach on the court, and B, recruit. And the sooner I figure that out, the better. And so I applied pretty much all, you know, non-Division I, from Division II to Division III, NAI, and junior college jobs, and interviewed for a small college assistant job in Ohio and in Kansas, which I thought was probably the no-brainer because it's close to where I lived. And then on Hoop Dirt, which is arguably the greatest website of all time, I saw there was some assistant opening at Lewis Clark State College in Idaho. And I didn't know that, I'd never heard of it. I didn't know there's anything besides Boise State and Idaho State. But I clicked on their website and saw they had a really nice facility. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, and it was a full-time job. I mean, didn't pay a ton, but it was, you know, it was more than $5,000. And so applied, didn't know anyone, but lo and behold, one of the people who had helped me, Chris Croft, who's now out of coaching, but he was a long time. He was at with Doc Sadler a lot at UTEP, Nebraska, and Southern Miss. But he had kind of been a guy who'd advised me, gave me some advice. And so he was a reference on my resume, which at the time my resume was not, you know, not great, but I put him as a reference. And the coach here at the time knew him because at one point Coach Croft had been at Washington State. And so that's how we got connected, and flew out here and checked it out for a day. And you know, I'm a big time homebody. I'm a mama's boy, love my family. And so staying in Kansas had most of the appeal, but I also figured, like, coaching close to home, anyone can do that, right? So I felt like if this is what I really want to spend my life doing or pursuing, I need to be as uncomfortable as possible. Which sounds pretty macho. I'm not a very macho person. It sounds pretty macho. So I came out here and, you know, figured I'd be out here for like 8 months, you know, and go back to the Midwest. And then lo and behold, man, that's been, I think 11 years now. This is my 11th year, I think. And so just have stayed out here. I was an assistant here for 6 years and then was fortunate to get a head coaching job at a small Christian college in Oregon. And I was there for 2 years, and then the head coach at LC here, he left to take a D2 job, and I went through the process and ended up getting this job. And so this is my fourth year, here at LC. And, it's, you know, if you would have asked me at multiple stops or multiple points in my career as an assistant coach or getting into coaching, I wouldn't expect it to be in Idaho. I thought I'd really pursue, you know, like the Division I thing, like I think a lot of young guys, but I'm 36, so I would like to say the door is not completely shut on what the future might hold. But every day I feel fortunate that I'm here, and I feel like, you know, I had a lot of great plans getting into coaching, and I'm very thankful that most of my plans did not work out, because the jobs I thought I wanted and the jobs I pursued, if I would have got them, I probably would not be in coaching anymore. And so I just feel very fortunate. Like every day I feel like I just stumbled blindly into a gold mine, and definitely want to be grateful for what I got. I think there's a lot of tough jobs out there, and every job is hard and has challenges, but I love where I work, who I work with, and the guys I get to coach. And, so yeah, that's kind of in a nutshell. There's, you know, every stop along the way you learn and you get challenged, and there's certain things you got to surrender and give up, and there's certain things, you know, you learn and add to your coaching toolbox, but also just who you are as a person and your identity. And I think, you know, you're a great example too. Most of us, you know, if you asked us at 23, 24, where we're going to be, oh man, we're going to be, you know, by the time we're 35, we're going to be, you know, at this, doing this. And in some ways, I think it's a good thing that I didn't always get what I wanted. And I think as you get older too, you know, your priorities definitely shift. I didn't get married till I was 30, didn't become a dad till I was 33. And now my priorities as a coach are way different than they were when I was 28, 29, or even, you know, obviously 25. And so, but that's the, in a nutshell, that's how I ended up at LC State and where I'm at now, and loving every minute of it, including the long bus rides.
For sure. Expect the unexpected is kind of, you know, kind of how your career has gone. And, you know, I can talk about a few things that you mentioned in there. You know, Coach Croft, you know, he's now coach, you know, he's working at Southern Miss right down the street from where I'm at. And he's helped me, you know, even though he's not in the profession anymore, he's helped me with a couple, knowing about some kids. And he helped me get a couple interns at our school, which was pretty cool. And, you know, awesome guy. And just having that one reference that has somebody familiar with whoever, you know, it's a large business. It's also a very small connected business.
It's crazy. And I give Coach Croft so much credit for who I, cause I know what he's done for me. I know he's done that for anybody that's reached out. And I think, like, you know, just being an absolute nobody at age 20, trying to figure out how I can go work camps or what I can do. And I'll know, you know, I wrote handwritten letters to a bunch of coaches, like everybody does. And, you know, he wrote back and it was like, yeah, obviously we're not gonna have, you know, a spot, you know, GA spot or anything like that in Nebraska, but like, hey, here's some things you can do. Here's some people you should connect with. And like, to me, I was like, wow, like this dude took the time out of his day. Like, I think Mark Turgeon was at Texas A&M. Then I think he wrote a quick handwritten letter back. And I was like, wow, like even though it was rejection, it was still like, wow, they took time out of their day to get back to me. And so that was always an encouragement. And yeah, guys like Chris Croft make this business, in these coaching organizations, you know, like no ego, right? Like Coach Croft, like looked out for others as much as he looked out for himself. And that's why like people like me are pretty indebted to him and just his kindness.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned Coach Mo, you know, I had the pleasure of working with him for 2 years at Minnesota, my freshman and sophomore year of college. You know, my sophomore year as the interim head coach at Minnesota, we spent a lot of hours late at night. His video skills weren't the best, so I was kind of his computer guy. I even helped him move out of his house. He fed me some KFC. He would coach in his jeans. He was obsessed with the Rockets and Yao Ming and the Pac defense. But Coach Mo, he's had a heck of a career too, you know, between Bradley and, you know, different stops along the way, you know, Minnesota, Oklahoma, but now at Boston College. So you got any good Coach Mo stories?
Man, I got too many probably. I remember my I was there 2 years, so the summer in between, you know, the three coaches were out on the road and I was back on campus because I had to finish. I was still doing my school, and obviously our guys were there for summer school, so just kind of holding the fort down. And I remember I get a call from Coach Mo, and you know, the first year he had like a dorm set up on campus, and he, you know, was like, well, hey, I want to get a house in my second year so I can have my kids and all that and stuff come and visit and hang out. And so he calls me like randomly one morning in July and says, hey, there's a really nice house, like a really good setup for what I need. It's close to the football field, close to campus. And the landlord is going to drive over. There's going to be in town. She lives out of town. She's going to drive into town. And I want you to go meet her at the house and check out the house and tell me if I should get it. And Coach Mo is, you know, he is class. Like, if you know Coach, like, he coaches in his jeans, yes, you know, but like Coach Mo is, you know, Italian suits, like the high major lifestyle, right? And I've slept more months than I can count, you know, just in a sleeping bag on the floor. And so I'm like, okay, like I'll check it out. But obviously, you know, like again, our tastes are what we're looking for are probably two different things, but I'll go meet him or meet the landlord. And so landlord shows up It's a pretty elderly woman. She gets out of the car and she says, I realize I forgot the keys to the house. And she lived like an hour, hour and a half away. And so I'm like, okay, well, let me call Coach Mo real quick. So I call Coach Mo and say, hey, like, you're just gonna have to check this out sometime later. She forgot the keys, so like, we can't go in. And he was like very adamant. He was like, no, this, it's a great location. It's a great spot. It's a great location. If I don't jump on this thing now, someone's gonna take it and I'm gonna be back to square one. So just walk around the house, look through the windows and then call me back and let me know what you think. So like me and this like 85-year-old woman are just walking around the house. Like I'm peering in the windows and I mean, I'm only doing it because I like want to be a good employee. Right. And I'm just like, this is ridiculous. And so I call him back and I'm like, yeah, like, he's like, so what'd you think? And I'm like, well, I mean, looking through the windows, it's got walls and floors and, you know, he's like, well, should I take it? And I was like, well, coach, like, I don't know what you're used to like living in. Like I live in an apartment, you know what I mean? Like, and he's like, well, should I take it? And I'm like, tell her I'll take it. Tell her I'll take it. So I'm now a real estate agent. And so I'm telling the lady like, yeah, oh yeah, he loves it. He's gonna take the house. And so, there's countless other stories, like just kind of the absent-minded professor with Coach Mo, but, an elite teacher of defense and, someone who obviously loves the game. And, you know, I only knew him as a head coach, but I would think he would be a tremendous asset as an assistant coach that, was a different pair of eyes defensively, and just his experience and like where he's at in his stage of life, what he can do for those players, you know, relationally and stuff like that. And so plenty more Coach Mo stories that if you were to ever listen, I probably won't share, but very fortunate. I mean, very fortunate. Like I said, I always tell myself, that was a really two hard years for me and, had to do stuff that was really out of my comfort zone. I'm the worst with video and technology, and that was probably the most anxiety. Like Synergy has saved so much time, but you know, back then there was no Synergy, cutting it up with Dartfish. And so it was a blessing though, like, cause it was really, really hard. Coach Mo was very demanding. It was a tough job. You know, Western Illinois doesn't have the greatest of facilities. And so there's a lot of challenges, but I look back, like, to have that at age 23 and 24 was good because again, it had to really like, it crystallized in my mind if this is what I want to do. Whereas I think, you know, sometimes if you're at a place where it's, you know, quote unquote, easier, you have more resources or you have more help, you know, what happens when you get older and you take over a job or you go somewhere where you don't have all that? Are you prepared for it? And so, like the miserable road trips because of Macomb's location and in the Summit League, that's back when Southern Utah was still in the league. And so it was really challenging 2 years, but it really helped me just like, man, like, an eye opener too, because most of the time, you know, for those of, you know, when you grow up and you're not really in tune with what the world of basketball is like, you just assume if anyone says Division I that it's like sunshine and roses and, you know, the streets are paved with gold. But when I got there, I was like, wow, this is not what I thought. You know, Division I, you see like the top 100 schools on ESPN, but you know, there's 350 plus Division I's, and there's a lot of things at our school here at LC that I would stock up with some Division I's in regards to facilities and even just administration and stuff. And so great learning experience for me. I think if I had been at, you know, a mid-major or a high major, I would be a D1 or bust guy. But because I was at a place that wasn't as high up on the ladder, it made me open to a lot of other things. And also just relationally, I just felt like if you can recruit the kids, you can have a great relationship with them. And ultimately, it's, you know, basketball is more about people than it is about basketball. And so that's why I've really enjoyed this, the non-Division I level so far.
That's awesome. Yeah, so you talked about the GA experience, and so you were very fortunate that you were, you know, I tell people a lot, hey, go to an NAI or Division II to do your GA because you get reps on the floor and you need those reps, or be a volunteer, like you said, at a junior college where you get that experience. It doesn't, you know, when you're young, it doesn't matter so much about location. It doesn't matter so much about money. It's about the reps that you get and the practice that you get. And you're a perfect example of that. So then you go to Lewis Clark LC and you do a really good job. You guys won as an assistant and such. And so you left a job and you went to a Division II NAI, like you said, a small school, and you became a head coach there. You were the first 8 seed ever to win your conference tournament. You won there, went to the national tournament, first time in a long time at that school. What did you learn as an assistant, as a GA and stuff, to prepare you to be a really small school head coach? And what led you to just taking that job besides being a head coach at a place that no one even really knows the name of?
Well, a big pull for it too. I just got married. So the head coach job at Corbin paid a little more than the assistant job at LC. And so my time in my life, I just got married. Corbin's a Christian school, which definitely aligns with my values and my faith and how I try to live my life and how I also try to coach. And then also, I think I was very comfortable as an assistant at LC. Didn't have kids. I wasn't making much, but it wasn't I could still, I love being here. I love the boss that I worked for. We won. But again, it was kind of like, okay, well, how many opportunities do you get to be a head coach? And I already been through two or three where I thought I should get really deep into the process and I'd make it through the first round and then not move forward. And that sucks, right? We've all kind of been there with certain different jobs. And so to me, it was how many opportunities are you going to get? Plus, I didn't have to come. I mean, it's still in the Northwest. It's in a more metro area. It's in the state of Oregon, which, Oregon has really good high school basketball. So I was like, okay, this is, can continue to grow me as a coach and my recruiting network. And so I think, a lot of it also was how many chances do you get to be a head coach at the 4-year level? I mean, you probably have better odds of being a brain surgeon or something like that. Yeah, I mean, it's just those jobs are really hard to get, good, bad, or ugly, regardless of location or level or salary, those jobs are hard to get. And so I was like, if I don't go after this, what job out there other than maybe trying to stay at LC? And if the coach leaves, maybe you get the job, but that's also not a guarantee, right? And so I just thought head coaching experience was huge. And so taking that was important. I think the things that I learned as a GA and as an assistant is just understanding it's going to be hard. It's in a really good league. It's in the league that we're in now. And other schools had, maybe some more tradition or some more resources. And so I think my experiences as a player and as a coach were, hey, that underdog blue collar chip on my shoulder, we're going to figure it out. We're going to figure out how to be successful and how to compete, maybe even above our talent level. And so I think those things really helped. I think the prep, the scouting and some of the teaching stuff that I learned from the different coaches I worked for was very beneficial and helpful. And then just, there's no other experience. And guys like Tommy Lloyd, obviously, or I'm not Tommy Lloyd, you go be an assistant for a long, long time and then boom, you hit the ground running as a head coach. For me, as much as I probably was prepared to be a head coach, I also know the only real way to be a head coach to be a head coach, right? And so as much as I was prepared, I also now look back and think about how unprepared I was. And so but it was an awesome opportunity to go learn and make mistakes and learn from them and figure out who you are. And I think that was probably the biggest thing of that 2 years was, okay, am I Coach Mo, or am I Brandon Renta, who I worked for 5 years? And who is Austin Johnson as a coach, as a recruiter, as, and so I think that 2 years, early on, I had no idea who I was. When I became a head coach, I tried to do everything that other people had told me I should do or that I had learned from them, and don't think we're very good at any of it. And so big time learning experience. And I think that 2 years was awesome. It was an undergrad in coaching, figuring out who I am, what works for me, what's realistic, what's my teaching style, how I, when I got hired as a head coach, the coach I had worked for 5 years was very calm on the sidelines. elite mental toughness to just like control his emotions. And, you know, I sat next to him for 5 years and I was like, yeah, that's who I'm going to be. Like, it helps our guys so much, you know, cause like, you're just calm. And, you know, I told myself that's who I was going to be. And then like, I just remember my first game as a head coach, like just like, and again, not necessarily like, you know, negative, but just like, I couldn't sit still and I'm pacing. And so I think that 2 years really trying to figure out, you know, being yourself. There's, and I, we all talk about that, right? Like, your players aren't dumb, the athletic directors aren't dumb generally, and so like, you got to be yourself, because at some point, like, that's going to be what wins or loses it. And I also, after, you know, my experience at Corbin, I realized too, like, you know, all of us at some point are probably going to get fired. I mean, most people get fired in this business, right? And so like, I just told myself, this is going to end. I want it to end like being me. And if me is an awful coach, okay, like, but I know this wasn't meant to be. But so I think, yeah, that 2 years is really big on trying to figure out who I am and, like, you know, trusting your gut. Got some good advice from some good people too. I had my second year there, I hired a guy who had been a longtime head coach at the college level, different levels. And he's giving me great advice, like, trust your gut. He's like, no one thinks about this team and these players more than you as the head coach. So yeah, you can go get advice or, you know, be open-minded, but at the end of the day, like, no one knows these guys better than you. And so, yeah, those 2 years were huge, huge in learning. Had some big wins, had some absolutely devastating, gut-wrenching losses that I remember vividly to today, and got to coach some awesome guys, and, you know, I've get invited to their weddings and stuff like that. We made a national tournament, did a lot of really cool stuff in 2 years, and was honestly figured I'd be there for, you know, a decade or so, until the LC job opened up. And then even then I wasn't necessarily tripping over myself to come back, but as fate would have it, as kind of how the dominoes fell, and realized like, this is something I wanted to pursue at LC State.
Yeah, your journey is unbelievable, but like, you mentioned some things that I think are really important to reiterate here. So you talked about figuring out who you are as a head coach. You know, a head coach at any level, high school, small college, junior college, Division I, like, learning and knowing who you are, what your identity is as a coach, as a leader, as a teacher, you know, what type of culture do you want to have, your core values, all those things. And, you know, I couldn't agree with you more with finding out, you know, who you are, and you're going to go down swinging with who you really are as a person. And that's one thing that me and you have talked about a lot in our friendship over the last decade of, you know, knowing who you are as a man and as a person, and as a father, like, that's who Austin Johnson is. And I look up to you for that. You mentioned another thing about staying calm on the sidelines. So, you know, we're all victims of it and different things. We think we're going to be one way, and then you get and horrendous call, or something doesn't go your way, or you drew up a play, everyone knew it, and the kid goes out there and doesn't do it right. You know, how you handle those emotions and your emotional intelligence, and how to, you know, model the way in terms of how you want to respond rather than react to what's happening, and what happens next can't be based on how you feel, and all those things that are so important, but they're so hard. And we can read and we can know all these things, but at the end of the day, if you don't know how to, if you don't know how to do that and handle those situations, I think it's really important. You'd laugh right now. I'm getting a FaceTime call of all people. Bob Boyd is FaceTiming in right now. That's awesome.
Oh my gosh, Bob, I said, what's up?
We'll have to call him back. We'll have to call him back.
Yeah.
I
think I just want to touch on two things we just talked about. So there's a difference. We tell our players too, there's a difference between playing with emotion and being emotional. And I am definitely someone who coaches with emotion. And I want my players to play with emotion, right? I don't want them to be robots. I want them to have, you know, the highs and lows are what make this memorable, right? And so I want there to be a level of emotion, but obviously once you get emotional, that's when you lose control. Like you said, you can't, you know, what happens next can't be based off how you feel. And then in terms of going back to authenticity and knowing yourself, I think it's almost, and I don't know, but I almost would think it's harder now because of all the resources at your fingertips. Like I watch all like the Buzz Williams stuff on Twitter and his, you know, his like the classroom videos. I'm like, man, this guy is a smart, like, you know, mind blowing stuff, but that's not me. And, or, you know, you watch some other, you watch like Tony Bennett and you're like, man, Tony Bennett is so calm, but like, I'm not Tony Bennett. And so I think it can be challenging, especially for young coaches, because there are a lot of great resources and there's a lot of great access to different coaches and styles and personalities, but like, and you can learn from all of them for sure, but you can't be all of them. And I think that was like a big challenge for me, is like, oh, I like these 50 coaches and everything they do, but like, you know, is it, can you really replicate it with your personality? Can you replicate it with your teaching style? Can you replicate it with the resources that they have? And so I think that's like, again, the great thing is there's a lot of ways to learn and grow as a coach because of the internet and social media. But at the same time, it's also like, it's easy to compare, you know, comparison is a thief of joy. And so it's also easy to be jealous, or, I mean, I'm as insecure as anybody. I'll look at, you know, some coaches' Twitter accounts and be like, man, they got it figured out. Or like, man, their players all love them. Like, my players don't all love me. And so it's easy, I think, to kind of almost get knocked off the path of authenticity because of all of the stuff that's out there. So that's a challenge, I think, to everybody, including me. I think it's a daily challenge for us as coaches.
Yeah. Continue to get better rather than be bitter or compare yourself to other people's race, because your race is unique and authentic to you. And understanding that, knowing that. And then the same thing with who you are as a coach has to do a lot with the players you recruit and what type of kid you are or what level you're at, because you don't always have control. You know, you being in the, you know, the Northwest, in the Pacific up there, like, it's different than the kids that I'm coaching in Mississippi, so the junior college level, and, you know, just age, maturity, you know, different backgrounds and all those things, and bringing them together. So you have a successful 2 years, and then you get the LC head coaching job. And I'm going to plug you for a second. I know you're not a big ego guy, but, you know, what you've done as a head coach, you know, you've only been a head coach for 6 years. So you're, you know, basically 5.5 years in, and you have 125 career wins. Unbelievable. You're back-to-back NAI coach of the year. Like, that's unheard of in any level, to be national coach of the year back-to-back years. You've won, you've had success, your kids are graduating, your kids are enjoying it, you're playing on a national level, and, you know, competing for a national title every year. So kind of a Nick Saban question, more or less, like, hey, you're, you know, not, maybe not quite that level, but you're winning, and you're winning at a high level. And, you know, getting to that point takes a lot of work, and, you know, but how do you handle that continued success? How do you keep your, you know, that needle moving forward? How do you keep the carrot for your guys and stuff? You know, winning, you've been very, very close to winning a national title. So how do you keep that moving? And what is it that you've done there that you feel like has contributed to your success, and how you continue to build that?
Well, I was very fortunate to take over a program that was already good. Right. A few things. I think, you know, this year is the youngest team I've ever coached. So I'll be curious to see how, I mean, we're 9-1 right now, but I'll be curious to see how we finish it out with this young and new group. But I think, and again, it's all the cliches are they're cliches because they're real. So I think, you know, being very relational and very intentional. And we always talk about, as a program, if we're together, but we're not honest, then we're not together. So can you tell the truth to your team? Can your team tell the truth to each other about, you know, their performance, about their buy-in, about their discipline? And so I would say that's been a big thing, is just trying to be as intentional and relational as humanly possible with our players, so that you can coach them really, really hard on the court. Player buy-in, you know, every coach tries to go about that in their own unique way, but that's really, you know, player buy-in is what. Obviously, you got to have a somewhat of a sound plan, right? You got to kind of have a roadmap for them. But I think, you know, player buy-in is really what makes it. It's fun to go to work. That's why you have a chance to win games maybe you shouldn't have a chance to win. It's why you can overcome deficits, or you can get through injuries, because player buy-in. And so for us, you know, the motivation is always to be our best and be the best when it matters the most. So we always, you know, the last few years, we've been our best at the end of the season. I can't sit here and specifically tell you why that is. That's been the case every year. We've been good, but we've found a way to be at our best, you know, that back end of February and into March. And so, I think we take a lot of pride in our prep with scouting and also in our skill work. I would say those are two really big, like, foundational things in our program, is, and not just skill work in terms of shooting, but we do a lot of defensive footwork stuff that most programs, you know, will do in their preseason stuff. And then once they get in a season, they kind of go away from, but we're doing like defensive slide, like, you know, some specific to us, we're doing some defensive footwork stuff in February that, you know, I don't think a lot of teams are doing, because again, I think that's a skill that can continually improve. And so we really want to be able to be solid on ball defensively. And so we're doing a lot of, our guys get tired of it, our guys probably hate it, but we do the same, you know, three or four drills every practice to start practice off. And a lot of it's defensive footwork, moving our feet. And so, but as far as a motivator, again, I can't tell you exactly why or how, but it's just been an awesome group. I think, like, you know, who you recruit matters, right? That doesn't mean you're going to hit 100% in recruiting, and you can only get to know people so much in the recruiting process. But if you get guys who can value being a part of something bigger than them, you know, you got a chance to be special. And you and I talked about this yesterday. You know, I've been fortunate to coach some unbelievable players, but every year we've kind of had a group where it's not just, okay, hey, well, if you can stop our first and second player from scoring, then you'll beat us easy every game. Like, we've had other guys step up, and that depth, and not so much like, oh, we've got 12 guys who can play, but just, you know, we've had six or seven guys who on any night can lead us in scoring. And so, but that's buy-in, and none of them have pointed fingers when they only took five shots because their teammates took 11 or 12. And so, I think that's been a huge piece of it too. I think it's harder to prep for teams like that, than just say, hey, let's take away this one guy and we can win. And so, the guys in our program, the assistant coaches, have all been elite. And, you know, I tell recruits, I think this kind of goes back to, like, I mean, you know, the guys we recruit are getting recruited, a lot of them by bigger schools, Division I's, you know, really good Division II's, things like that. And so, but, you know, we're not going to compromise your experience here at LC State. You know, we're not going to private, you know, jet everywhere. You're not going to probably make a bunch of money in the NIL and stuff like that. But I'm going to coach you just as hard and be just as demanding as I would if I was the head coach of Division I school. And so you're not going to be compromised on how much you're pushed. And so, I think that's something we really try and tell guys up front in recruiting. And so they know how serious, like, we take this. And there's way more to life than basketball, but when you're in the film room, when you're in the weight room, and when you're on the court, that should be the most important thing at that minute to you. And so, we've just been fortunate to get some phenomenal guys that have found ways to probably be better than they really are, if that makes sense. There's buying in with skill work, buying into some challenging things. I think we do some things that if you would have asked me 6 or 7 years ago that, you know, oh, I wouldn't ask that guy to do that because he physically can't. And so just trying to open guys' minds up to what they're really capable of doing physically, I think has allowed us to be versatile and more connected and be able to overcome injuries and things like that.
Yeah, that's special. And you mentioned something about being the best at the end of the year, and everyone says, hey, I want to be our best in February and March, and, you know, potentially into April if that's where your season ends. But, you know, I think that your behaviors as a program and as a staff and that with your players, like, come before your success because of the foundation that you built. I think it is unique. You talked about the footwork and the things that you traditionally see within a program and what you know, but sticking with a specific thing that you think continues to work and continue to build, whether they hate it or not, they still love winning. Yeah. And the day, anyone, when things are going good, it's easy to be bought in. It's when you're facing that adversity, your things aren't always going your way, or, hey, I'm the backup four man, but I should be starting. But if you can let that stuff go, and, you know, hey, I got 10 starters. Of course I do. Well, you know, how can we paint the picture so they understand, you know, it's bigger than us. It's bigger than, you know, your individual accolades. The team wins, usually win. And, you know, it's helped a lot of different people.
There's no one who goes to cut the net down who
is mad.
Like, when you're cutting the net down, like, hey, it was all worth it. And hey, the role I had, like, that helped us get to cut the nets down. Now, obviously not every team's going to cut the nets down, but, like, there's so much truth to that. And, if you can get the player buy-in, But it's challenging. It's tough. I mean, we lost, you know, in our game that we lost this year, you know, we're young, but it's, you know, you still want to, once you can get them on the right train, the right path, they can overcome a lot. But for a lot of young guys, it's still so much outcome based, like you and I have talked about. And so we have some young guys, and the game that we lost, even at halftime, we were not playing well. The other team was playing really well. It was a good team from Arizona. But it's almost like you got to tell the guy, hey guys, like we're 7-0, we're a top 20 team, and we're getting beat. Like, we're not, like, that's the worst of the situation. Like, it's okay. Like, we're a good team. We can figure this out. That's what good teams do. The sky is not falling. And so even on good teams, you still have to redirect, and kind of like you talk, I mean, get them to see your vision and to continue to buy into it.
Yeah. Every team has their issues. It's just, yep, what issues do they have, and how do you combat them, and how do you, yep, continue to keep them bought into it? We always say, hey, the halftime score is at least relevant score in sports. You know, we were down 23 the other night and came back and won by 13 points. We were down by 10 at halftime, but 23 with 5 minutes to go in the first half. So continue to preach what you preach and do what you do. And, you know, one possession at a time, one play at a time, one day at a time, winning your specific day, rather than looking ahead and being attached to those outcomes. We've talked about that before too, is, yep, you know, it's hard because that's everything that our society emphasizes, you know, popularity, likes, winning. That's, you look on social media and you only see successes, you know, yep, and it's, yep, hard not to want to have that, because we can turn anywhere now and read about people's successes. And when it's not happening for you, how do you feel? And so, you know, finding ways to, that shows, contributes to your leadership and what the type of kids that you're recruiting. And, you know, that's the best thing about sports, is learning how to handle adversity, because our lives aren't always going to be perfect, and learning what that looks like. You're a big man of faith. I know you have, you know, you talked about your wife earlier. I know she played and coached, correct?
Yeah, she played. She's the real athlete and coach. She played volleyball at both Gonzaga and here at LC, and then she coached volleyball at the junior college level, and she also coached at Washington State. So she
might be the second best coach in your family, is that what you're saying?
She was an assistant at Washington State at age like 24 or 25, and so she was much further ahead in the curve than I was in my coaching career. So it's awesome to have a spouse who kind of has had that athletic background and understands like the different pressures of being a coach, but also the pressures of being a student athlete.
Yeah. So where I was getting with that, so that your faith and family as a core value as a human being, we've had a lot of conversations even about that. Talk to us a little bit about how you know, you haven't compromised any of your values as a person since you became a head coach. And, you know, how do you put those two things into your family with your two young kids, your wife? You know, a lot of people are coming from different areas. You have some local kids, but again, you talked about the distance. Leaving home is hard to do, and being in an area where you don't know a lot of people, and, you know, family nearby, and, you know, having your kids and, you know, kind of being isolated. Talk to us about that.
So we do it. I mean, every program does stuff with their guys. So I'm not going to act like we're reinventing the wheel, but like, it's like one thing we're doing this year, you know, with COVID, that was really hard because you couldn't do because of protocols on, you know, from schools and from states, there was not a lot we couldn't do as much with our guys off the court with team dinners and things like that. And so, so like one thing for us is we always want our guys to know we care about them as more than just basketball players. And you know, and every coach knows, there's certain guys that need that even more than others, right? I mean, you're not pouring equal energy into all 15 guys. It's some for sure are getting more, maybe they should, but you know, they're you're focused on all of them. But it's like this year, every Monday, we watch film from the games, you know, Friday, Saturday, or whenever we played last, and we do a team meal on campus. And so even when we, you know, lost on a Saturday, Monday, we're watching the film, which obviously was not fun. But then, you know, my wife is a saint and she makes food for all the guys. And so then we eat as a team, and I got my two kids in there. And so I think showing your players that there's more on your plate than just being a coach, and that there's more in your sphere, more in your world than just being a coach, I think really lowers that barrier, that coach, the some of the negatives of the player coach barrier, if that makes sense. And so I want our guys to see that you can pursue your passion as a coach or any career. Like, you can be extremely ambitious with your career, but you can also be a husband and a father who values your family. Now it's hard, obviously, like it's not easy and it's not always gonna be perfect, but I think so often in coaching, it's an either or, and I don't think it always has to be. I mean, I've been around coaches who have a lot of success and money and accolades, but like their home life or their family life is not what you would want your players' home life or family life to be. And so we try to really be transparent with our guys as a family, have them over a lot, have them interact with our kids a lot. You know, when you're 18, 19, you're not thinking about being a dad. At least I know I wasn't. But it was huge for me when I played to be around someone's family who also like really wanted to win a lot of basketball games. And so just being mindful of our guys and where they're at. And, you know, all coaches know, like, you can have, if you have 15 players on your team and 14 of them are in, you know, are doing great, where's your focus going to be on? It's going to be on the one who's not. And so trying to find that energy and that balance to try and connect with each kid, you know, that's why I think coaching is so draining. But for us as a family, very fortunate that like my wife and I view this as a ministry, and we're partners in it. And so we really try to open. We have guys from Australia. We've had guys from Mississippi. We've had players live with us in the summer that needed a place to stay. We try to be, you know, we'll never be someone's quote unquote family, right? You only really get one of those, but we try to make sure our guys know, like, we will literally give you the shirt off our backs if that's what you need. And if that's, you know, what's going to help you make it in terms of getting your degree and having the best experience possible. And so I think access is huge for coaches and players, that access, not just on the court access, but off the court access.
Level of care, man, is special. And, you know, people care as an assistant, they care more as a head coach, and they care more as a father. Like, there's the level of care, yeah, just kind of contributes so many different things. And
that's, you know, and that kind of goes back to some of the best advice I got when I became a head coach was a buddy of mine. He coaches at a D2 in California. He said, you have to fight, like, your assistants will care and they'll be good, but they'll never care as much as you. But like, they can't, because they're not hit, like, and so you can't hold that against them. And at first I didn't, you know, quite get what he meant, but yeah, I mean, once you're fully in charge of a group of young people and you've got the AD as your boss, like, there's way more. And so and then, like you touched on, I mean, once you become a dad, it changes too, because, you know, as a coach, we don't deal a ton with parents, but obviously in the recruiting process, it's allowed me to have a much better perspective on, like, okay, like, this guy I'm recruiting, he's important to me, but he's way more important to his parents. And so, you know, this guy that I'm recruiting, he's the most important thing in his parents' life. So how can I make sure that I, like, respect that and make sure they know I'm aware of that, and he's not just a basketball player and I'm not just a coach. And so, yeah, once you go from assistant to head coach, then I think too, once you get married and have kids, like, that's, you know, if you're doing it right and if you really care about both, it's like, that's what gives you the most perspective. And my oldest son is 3 years old and he loves it. You know, calls it daddy's team, and he loves being around daddy's team and daddy's guys. And, but I think my perspective will change even more as he becomes 9, 10, 11, right? Like, once he starts playing sports and I see it more from the parent view, like, I think my perspective will be even deeper. And I think I'll be a better coach because of that. Just in terms of, you know, understanding and even being more empathetic than I am. And so I'm excited, you know, the game of basketball, like, I could get fired tomorrow and this career would have been a million times more than I could have ever dreamed or hoped it would be. But I am excited knowing, like, and you're probably the same way. Like, we look back at our first couple years as a head coach and we're like, man, if I could go back and do this differently, I for sure would. Well, I know in 5 years, I'm gonna look back and say, man, if I could go back, you know, to 2020 or 2021, I would do this differently, or I'd do this better. And so I'm excited just about that. Like, the core values, it'll never change, right? But so much of what we do can get better. It can be improved upon. And then there's also some stuff you gotta just leave behind that you think is important at a certain stage in your career or a part of your program that you realize maybe wasn't quite as important. And so I'm excited about, you know, about that growth and looking back and seeing how it all develops.
Yeah, clarity, it gives you power as you continue to get better, like knowing specifically how to handle each situation. It changes every person and player, but you just get more experience, and nothing can beat experience, especially as a head coach. You mentioned one other thing that I just want to touch on, that I'm a big believer in. Hey, you're a player and I'm recruiting you. Your future is nothing to gamble with. You know, a kid's most valuable asset is his future or her future. Yep. And the parent's most important asset is their kid. And so learning how to hit that home and let them know, hey, I might not be the best basketball coach, or I might not be the best location or whatever, but no one will care more than we will about your son and his future, I think is extremely important. So we got time for two more questions real quick. Is there anything that any questions that I should have asked or you want me to ask or that you want to talk about before I dive into my last question?
No, I could talk hoops and philosophy with you all day long, but I know that's not an option. So I'm trying to think. The one thing I'll say, and again, cheesy, corny cliche, is, you know, if there's anything that I've learned over the last 2 years with the pandemic is, you know, if you're a coach and a teacher and an educator, like, what a great opportunity you have. The world, to me, it's been galvanized that there is a great, you know, we're not curing cancer or figuring out how to colonize, you know, the moon or Mars, but your players might. And like, there's never been a greater need for mentors, for advocates, for guides, for encouragers, for teachers than there is now with everything that our young people have gone through. I mean, it's been obviously challenging for all of us of any age, but it's a really hard time, I think, to be a coach and to be a teacher. But it's never been probably more needed than it is now, especially people who really care about the right things and care about your players and the people that God's entrusted you with, because that's, man, what a gift. Like, I remind myself of that too. Like, man, like, how fortunate am I, but also what responsibility it is that, like, we got 17 guys on our roster. 17 guys chose to come play. For sure, they came to play at LC State. I'm not acting like they 100% came to play for me, but that was a part of it. And so that's a lot of weight, right? But what an opportunity, and I believe, you know, God has prepared us all for a time such as this, you know, where kids coming off the pandemic and the different things that every kid's going through mentally and emotionally, and or even, you know, even on a more superficial basketball level, like the high school kids who didn't get to play AAU or the JUCO kid who wants to move on, but because everyone got that COVID year, like, it's just, what a time to be a truth teller and someone who can just love on the young people and try and encourage them and try and keep them on that straight and narrow path.
Yeah. You could pout or prepare, or you can blame, complain, make excuses, or you just keep competing. And, you know, we need more people that are about the right things in our profession. And, you know, that's what Rising Coaches does. That's what, you know, our friendship is like. You know, it's authentic. You're about the right things. And we need more people like you in our profession that understand that concept. And for those who are listening and don't always get the outcomes that you want, you are making a difference. And remember that.
For sure.
So my last question.
It's the last thing I'll say too. Like, I mean, we're not our record, right? Like, none of us coaches are our record. None of us are as good as we probably think we are, as good as our record might show, but none of us are also, like, we're so much, just like your players are more than their numbers, you as a coach are more than your numbers. And hopefully, I think sometimes we live in such a competitive society, it's easy to attach value to, you know, like, for example, I work for Coach Molinari. He's not necessarily a household name, but, like, that dude is one heck of a basketball coach, right? Like, and he's more than those, whatever those numbers are compared to Coach K at Duke, right? Like, we're all more than our numbers, just like our players are more than their field goal percentage or rebounds per game.
And you treat all your players differently, but at the end of the day, you still treat your players. And that's really what it's about. So my last question, maybe a little bit challenging or outside the box one, but what is the best thing that can happen in your life right now? Coach Austin Johnson, what is the best thing that can happen in your life right now?
Man, gotta be careful what I wish for, right? I think, you know, adversity is a relative term, right? But I think adversity is the best thing that can happen to me probably every day of my life to remind myself that I don't have it all figured out, to remind myself that my hope and my peace and my identity comes from Christ and not from my paycheck or us winning basketball games. And I think there is no better teacher than adversity. There is no better reality than understanding, you know, your place in this world, your place in your program or your business or your organization than adversity. And so as much as I don't enjoy adversity, that's probably the best thing that can happen to me as a husband and as a father and as a coach is continue, you know, none of us are a finished product, whether you're 18, whether you're 35, whether you're 65, like until we take that last breath, like none of us are a finished product. So I think, you know, God is always pruning us. Our profession is always pruning us. And like, it's never going to be super easy or comfortable. And so I think for me, best thing that happened to me is to continue to have some level of adversity. That's not me wishing illness upon myself or anything like that, but if that's what God has in his plans. But I just think adversity is such a great teacher, and it makes you grateful for the times when things aren't, you know, filled with adversity. And so I think that's it, man. Like think about the adversity that you've been through has led you to who you are and where you're at today. And I kind of go back to too, like if all of our hopes and dreams had all come true, we wouldn't be very tough people. And we wouldn't have experience, we wouldn't have wisdom, we wouldn't be able to, again, not that we're, you know, Gandhi or these super wise people, but we wouldn't have anything to give anyone. Like if you don't go through adversity, you have nothing to give anybody. And so I think that's the greatest thing you could have. And I say that, I act like I am welcoming adversity with open arms. I'm not. No one's more of a sensitive softy that wants everything their way than me, but I know that that's where everything is in that adversity.
It's a great answer, and you know, you're a great servant leader, man. I really appreciate our friendship and how authentic you are. And you know, more guys need to be, you know, not necessarily like you, they got to be themselves, but they got to understand the core values and, you know, being able to handle adversity in the perspective and, you know, family and faith. So really appreciate you being on here. Thank the listeners for, you know, listening and being a part of this. And hopefully you guys can continue to change lives and influence people the right way.
Appreciate it, my man. Hopefully we can catch up at one of these Final Fours one of these years.
Definitely. Definitely. Look forward to our next conversation. Again, thank you guys for listening.
Thanks.